All right, and welcome to this midweek podcast. Currently, I'm joined with Joshua Cutchin.
Hello.
Right, Josh. There you are. And perhaps Red Pill Junkie will be joining us. We're not 100% sure. Mike is off this week. And I want to say that I finally fixed our iTunes issue.
Hooray!
I am not what you would call a fan of iTunes. And this is one of those reasons. So this is what was happening. First of all, when I initially set this up, just a little bit of explanation here. When I initially set up the site for Where Did the Road Go back in January of 2013, I had an HTML-based site, and I used Blogger to post the shows so that way I would have a regular RSS feed, and that's what I fed to iTunes. Thanks to John Chuter, who runs Deprogrammed Radio, and airs this show and the midweeks on his very excellent radio station. He taught me how to use Joomla to program the site, and we eventually moved everything over. But what we did originally is we left the HTML site and the Blogger and everything, and we built another site in a separate folder on the same domain. So when it was ready to go, there was no long downtime. We just changed the root directory to the folder. And there was the site with all the content in one place rather than using Blogger. Well, the graphic that iTunes was grabbing was on the old site. And once we changed the root directory, that was no longer accessible. Now, we did this a while ago, and no one reported any problems. And over the last year or so, people have been like, I can't download your stuff on iTunes. And most people can. Most people had no problem, but every once in a while, it would download the entire show and then error out saying this download couldn't be completed. And I now can assume that it's because it couldn't download that image. Now, why this only affected certain people, I have no idea. But that was one of the frustrating things about it.
Yeah. So it even affected me. So it's not just the people on the other side of the mic.
Yeah, I could download it every time I tried. I never had an issue with it. It was very hard to troubleshoot because it was kind of random who it affected. So last night I was sitting there going, why does this still have old artwork? Because I changed the artwork a while ago and it still had the original artwork. And I said, this is probably pointed somewhere else. And iTunes doesn't let you just log in and change something in your podcast. It gets everything from the RSS feed. So I use FeedBurner, and I had changed everything in FeedBurner, but I missed the section for iTunes, and this is where the problem was. So the section for iTunes was still pointed to that old link that doesn't work anymore. So I went in, and I was just trying to fix the graphic. I wasn't even thinking about fixing the show because I didn't know what to do. I was just like, let me just at least fix this graphic. And I went in, and I changed the address to the new graphic. And I saved it, and it said, you know, it's going to take a while to update to iTunes. Yeah, okay, that's fine. And as soon as it updated, apparently people were able to download it. So the whole problem was it couldn't find the graphic that no longer exists and hasn't existed in like 2 years. So thanks. I don't know why it just wouldn't, you know, why this only affected some people, but thanks, Apple. That was a fun one to figure out.
Well, I'm just glad it got figured out. I mean, I had run into my share of people even at ForkFest who said that they were having sort of trouble. So it's very reassuring to know that this issue's out of the way.
Yeah, and now I know how to fix it if something like that happens again. Because to me, it seems like you should be able to just go into iTunes, click on your podcast, and edit data.
Well, it's not surprising to me that this issue arose because for me, just as I consider myself relatively computer savvy, but iTunes has gotten less and less intuitive over the years in my experience.
Yes.
And like, you know, I hop on my iPod or my computer and I have to select that I want to search for files from that device. And it's just like, really? Come on. Of course, that should be the default setting.
I'm not a big Apple fan to begin with. And every time I have to deal with this, it just, you know, I mean, I realize Apple and Peace and Windows, I mean, they're just kind of preferences, really. Both are good. It's not that. But to me, I can't stand the way Apple puts things together. And even when I signed up for iTunes initially, I went through a nightmare situation where when I create a password, I don't put it into the site that's requesting the password. I open a notepad and I type out the password, and then I copy and paste it in so I know the password is right. And when I get done, I save it to an encrypted file so I have it. And this way I can't possibly mistype the password. When I made the iTunes account to put Where Did the Road Go On, you know, I went through the whole thing. It said, okay, yep, everything's good. You know, confirm your password. Okay, great. Now you have to log in. And I go to log in and it says your password is wrong.
And I sat
there going, well, that's impossible because I just copied and pasted it from the same place I did before. And so eventually I had to say, you know, okay, I forgot my password. And it goes through the whole thing. And I put the same password in. And it didn't recognize it as an old password or anything. And I'm like, what is going on? So I put it in. And I go to log in again. It says your password is wrong. I'm like, oh, if I could kick the internet, I would love to right now.
Yeah, I've had some issues with my Apple ID getting mixed up. I actually have like 3 or 4 different Apple IDs because they've messed up the password or they aren't able to send me the forgotten password link for whatever reason.
I did eventually get it to work, obviously, because Where the Road Goes on iTunes. I made yet another password, I think, that included a whole bunch of swearing at Apple. And I used that, and it worked.
Nice.
Well, and then I got in, and it said, oh, you're using an old version of iTunes. Click here to, you know, download the new version. So I click there. It takes me to a page, and it says, here's the version you need. And I click it and download it and double-click it, and it says, this version does not work on your computer.
Of course. You know, my experience, and you might be able to speak to this in a different way, but in my experience, I mean, I have all Apple products, but in my experience, it's been I love Apple hardware and I love Microsoft software.
Mm.
Does that sort of hold true with your line of work?
I think, well, Apple hardware is not that different than PC hardware, as far as I know. A lot of the parts are made in the same places. I mean, I guess the design is a little different, is what it comes down
to. Maybe I am woefully underqualified to speak about this.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they do it, but I'm pretty sure pretty much all these computer companies make the same parts in China. You know, sure. And it's all just imported, and a lot of companies, they just take it and then put their name on it.
Yeah, true. It's sort of like the difference between getting different types of cars, you know.
Yeah.
This car is so-and-so equivalent of the Equinox or whatever, yeah.
Windows is messy, but I know my way around Windows, and I like the messiness. The messiness allows you to do more and change more, but it also opens you up to more problems.
Right.
Whereas Mac is more locked down, thus less susceptible to problems, but it drives me crazy, especially as a technician who doesn't work on Macs all the time, when I have someone who has a problem with a Mac, I have to sit there and go, okay, logically this should be here, but it's not there. So now I'm going to have to go online and figure out how to change that.
Right. And see, I was someone who lost like 2 or 3 different hard drives to viruses, even though I had antivirus definitions and everything. And I know what everybody's saying, Joshua Cutchin is sketchy. But, you know, I just, for whatever reason, after that, I just went on the Mac, and it's been the easiest, most painless thing that I've done in a long time. So feel free to anyone out there, feel free to crucify me for it. I know I'm speaking for Michael Hughes when I say that too, though.
Oh yeah, Mike is a total Apple guy. And like I said, to me, in all honesty, to be unbiased, they're both about equal in a lot of ways. When it balances all out, it's a matter of preference. My preference tends to be Windows, and it's not because I think Microsoft is great by any means.
Oh no, my sister just got her first Mac, and she's sort of going a little bit nutty with the best way to organize it, because the OS is not organized in an intuitive way for me. I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
All right, and so this is the Tech Night Owl.
Exactly. So I had sent you this link too, and this got posted. This got posted to Coast to Coast, actually, put this up. And it says, Google Earth captures giants at Giza.
Yeah.
And this is so much a sign of what's wrong with the internet and these things. And it fits into that theme of technology here. So what you have is, I mean, Google Earth or anyone who, or Google Maps and what is it? Street View is what it actually is that they're using. This guy looks around, you know, the pyramids and stuff, and then he questions what the little villages are. And I don't know exactly what they are, but they could just be, you know, poorer areas of Cairo.
Yeah, I feel like unless you've been to that part of Egypt, of Cairo, you probably shouldn't ask, like, what are these doing there, you know?
Yeah, it could have been any number of things we were looking at, but he was acting like they were mysterious. And then he gets into the street view in Cairo, and he says, there are giants in this picture. And what it is you just got people closer to the camera than the rest of the people in the image. And it's very obvious, if you look at it, that it's just people close to the camera. And he's like, oh, look at how big they are. They're giants. They must be the Anunnaki, still just walking the streets of Cairo.
Yeah, it's gotten to the point where, with a lot of these stories, where whenever I see something about Google Images or Google Earth pop up, rather, I tend to immediately discount it, because I think there was just a story a couple days ago about someone seeing a Google Earth image above one of the poles that tended to look like a sea serpent. Mm-hmm. And look, guys, I'm a fan of this stuff. You know, I think there's a lot of validity to a lot of these stories, but we're not going to get the answers from Google Earth. And I mean, like, on occasion you will find landmark-based discoveries from Google Earth. I believe there were some mounds in Eastern Europe a couple years ago that were discovered that were sort of a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
But you aren't going to see Nessie on Google Earth. You aren't going to see a serpent on Google Earth. And any sort of – these giants. Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing where there are so many different ways to explain away what you're seeing here. And does it look sort of anomalous on first blush? Yes, it does. I mean, it totally does. But it's not something that I think you could just jump to this Anunnaki conclusion. You know, that requires a leap of faith that I'm just not willing to make. I mean, you've also got to look at, you know, when you used to take photographs. Used to have a lot better results with zooming in and resolution and whatnot. There are so many artifacts inherent in digital photography of any sort, but especially in the sort of digital photographs that you get that are placed on websites and whatnot. The loss in resolution can do a lot to sort of fudge details. And I think you have to take that into consideration too.
Well, and that's like video too. I mean, digital video, I mean, high definition video. Yeah, it looks great, but realistically, you're opening yourself up to glitching because it's digital, which you don't. I mean, not that you can't have analog glitches. You certainly can, but digital glitches look weirder. You know, when you see a glitch in an analog tape or something, you can kind of tell that's the tape. When it's digital, you're going, what's happening there? Is that person changing? What's, you know, what's going on?
Right, exactly. I mean, you can look at a very mundane – you could take a picture of me or a video of me, rather, from several hundred yards away. And if you zoom in enough, the pixels will make it look like I'm literally, like, mutating into something different, because that's the way that the technology works. And this, to me, seems – if it's not just simple, you know – forced perspective, then maybe it's, you know, maybe it's something along those lines. And again, everybody who wants to cry me off as being a skeptic or a debunker, you know, I'm not that guy, but this is just one of those stories that I just have to roll my eyes at.
It's totally a perspective thing. I mean, if you look at it closely, you can see the perspective that it was taken at and where these people are. They're I didn't even realize there was anything, you know, I'm like, okay, where's the image? Oh, that's the image?
Shh, I'm trying to be nice.
There was a TV series in the UK. I'm trying to remember what it was called, but it had something with a priest, father something, and I can't remember what it is, but someone had sent me a link to this little segment where they had these toy cows on the table. And he was trying to explain to this kid, and there are cows out the window, and there are cows on the table, and he's going small, and he's pointing the ones on the table, and he's looking out the window, he goes, far away. And the kid looks at the ones on the table. He goes, huh? And he's like, small, far away. He's like, but they're the same size.
It wasn't the Vicar of Dibley, was it?
I don't know. It was something like that, but it was killing me. But that's exactly what this brought to mind. It's like, okay.
Oh, totally. Totally. And even if you don't want to like admit to that, I see literally about 10 cars or vehicles on the street. And the idea that everybody's just going about their business while these two 12-foot Giants. Guys walk by.
Yeah.
Really does strain credulity for me.
And I mean, it's amusing, but at the same time, this is the type of stuff that pollutes the like paranormal internet.
Yeah, I mean, and it's the sort of thing that when you sit down next to someone on a plane, to steal sort of a scenario from Richard Dolan, when you sit down next to someone on a plane and they ask you what you do, it's the reason that they roll their eyes. You know, there are a lot of people doing good work out there on a folkloric basis, on a science basis, on a philosophical basis, but then you have these people who are seeing things where they just aren't there. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, and it's just, and this is a technology thing, so it's appropriate to how we started the show, because you didn't get this type of stuff back in the 80s because we didn't have the technology, the proliferation of all these images and these digital, you know, Earth View and Street View and all this type of stuff. And there's all kinds of weird stuff you can find on Street View that's glitches and things like that.
Right, but I mean, look, the thing you've got to realize is that if to me, where you're going to get your real deep Fortean insights, your real deep sightings are not going to be from media, because media has always been exploited by whatever this phenomena is. And not necessarily in a direct way, like the phenomena is exploiting the media, but rather to say that, you know, you look at sort of the airship wave.
Mm-hmm.
Where there were some decent sightings, but then they sort of snowballed out of control in the media of the time and, you know, got into goofy newspaper stories. So always, I mean, you've got to look at anything that comes out through any sort of media outlet with a grain of salt. It's really still, again, it's the individual witness that is the backbone of all sorts of unexplained phenomena, and that's what you should still concentrate on, I think.
Yeah, the problem with old sightings like that, though, is that you can't talk to the witnesses anymore.
Well, right, but in terms of grafting that model onto the modern age, I think that sort of philosophy still holds true, that it's not so much the media is going to not the media in like an, you know, Alex Jones sense, but the media just in terms of like a profit generating enterprise is still going to seek out stories that are sensational, that are eye-catching, even if not sensational, that are eye-catching. And if something could be, they'll probably report it as, you know, as a possibility. But you really, but in terms of like looking at stuff in the modern day, you really have to look at the individuals and really come back around to that. Especially like multiple witness sightings, not necessarily things that will get media coverage nowadays, because, you know, it's, I guess the Fortean version of it bleeds, it leads would be like, if it's strange, that's great. That doesn't rhyme, but.
And what was interesting in relation to this is when I posted the Jeff Ritzman 3-part interview there, I had a lot of people commenting, well, I can't believe that all these weird things happen to one person. But it seems to me, and I commented at the beginning of the interview we did with Tony last week, that I think that is generally the rule, not the exception. It seems like people who have these experiences have a bunch of them. They don't just generally have one experience.
Right. I mean, it's so here's my thinking on this is multifaceted. Did I congratulate you last week on that interview series? Because I really felt that was fantastic.
Yeah, well, it was mostly Jeff.
Oh, well,
it really was. I mean, he had his story to tell, and he told it well.
But all those things, you know, that it came together in a really great way.
I was happy.
You know, it's not often that you get that nice intersection of credible and spooky, and not dry. You know, so
yeah,
kudos
yeah.
to you on that. Here's my thinking on that whole series is number one. He is so self-critical of his own experiences.
Yeah.
Which to me is the earmark. It's the telltale hallmark of whether or not somebody should be believed. You know, the problem that I always come up against is when people say, I had, you know, this thing happened to me and it was the aliens from Zeta Reticuli and they're telling me that they're mining gold from the Earth's core to power their starships, and that's when I turn off. It's when people say, look, I saw this thing, this is what it said, I don't know what that means or if it's true or not. Those people are the ones that resonate with me, and I put you in that category as well. But again, coming back to what you said, these things do cluster around people. I've met people, and again, I feel like I'm sort of maybe trotting over some territory that I talked about in Tony's interview, but I meet people that have had multiple experiences like you, who are very open about the meaning of them and who are very open about how, you know, non-committal they are about them. And those are the people that I tend to believe more. And Jeff definitely does not seem to be married to any particular interpretation of what he's experienced. And, you know, I think of somebody else that really strikes me that way is Mike Cleland. If anybody should be able to say there are aliens from space who are abducting us and they're taking us and they're interfacing with the owls, it should be Mike Cleland. But you know what he does? He says, look, this is what I've experienced. This is what I've found. These are the people that I've talked to. This is what it seems to be, but I'm still open to other interpretations. And to me, that is intellectual honesty at its finest. And I really have to salute Jeff and you and Mike for doing that, because to me that's the gold standard for people that we should be, not that we should be listening to, not that we shouldn't be listening to other people, but that's the gold standard for quality witnesses, are the ones who are really self-critical of their experiences.
The thing with Jeff Ritzman, where he's talking to the guy in the cloak, mm-hmm. and he tells them they come from like some miniature universe inside of whatever. And Jeff said, I think Jeff said, I don't know that I believe that, but all right, it's an interesting idea.
Right. I mean,
go on.
I was going to say, you know, it really does resonate in a sort of a hermeneutic sort of way. As above, so below.
Yeah.
Sort of philosophy. which personally, with what I've seen about the phenomena, makes me sort of lean into that a little bit. But yeah, I think that was actually around about the same time that he mentioned how self-critical he was of his own experiences. And I've seen a lot of people, I read some of those YouTube comments and whatnot about like, I can't believe that he's had all these things happen to him, but he's not saying what they are. He's just saying, look, this is what happened to me. You know, I'm not fitting it into a greater framework. It's just what happened.
And if you're, I don't know, I feel like the people who are faking it have a agenda that they want to achieve. You know, they want you to believe that they were abducted by aliens. Whereas when Jeff talks about his story, it keeps it in sort of this ambiguous, I don't know what's happening. So what's really the agenda there?
Yeah, I would substitute agenda for narrative.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, because I think that there are some people who are genuinely just wanting to be believed, but I think that they're caught up in what the major commentators have to say about the subject, and they just sort of parrot that back. You know, I saw this, so it must be aliens, because this one guy who has a doctorate who hypnotizes people says that this is what's happening. It must be hybrids.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, back in, let's see, when it would have been around first half of last year, I had Chad and Alta Dillard on, and they had a whole list of weird experiences they had, and they didn't prescribe any particular interpretation to it. I mean, some of it sounded like something you would hear from a UFO, you know, abduction encounter, but other things didn't at all. They were just very weird, strange experiences. And when I talked, you know, initially I was a little hesitant to just bring them on. And as they told me a little more, I was like, okay, you're not pushing a narrative here. You're just talking about what you experienced, and you're not married to any idea about it. So sure, let's do this.
Right. And contrast that with the Miguel and Charmaine hybrid episode, which not to bag on later guests, but those were two people who saw a phenomenon, had things happen to them, I genuinely believe, but they came yes. with, they came to it with this narrative in mind. And, you know, I feel like a lot of people who are being critical of people like Jeff having poltergeist experiences and whatnot don't realize the extent to which these things cross over, to the extent to which these things overlap. Like, newsflash, guys, it's not unheard of. In fact, it's quite common for abductees to have poltergeist experiences, to have experiences of clairvoyance, to have to quote my latest blog post, to have magical experiences. It's an uncomfortable thing to admit, but it happens. It totally happens.
And near death experiencers have the same thing happen to them.
Right. And that's something that Miguel Red Pill Junkie wrote an excellent essay on in the Paracast newsletter one time about the similarities between near-death experiences and an alien abduction, in addition to Kenneth Ring.
His well, birth. Of course. Yeah,
of course. But yeah, that's something that people don't want to admit, and is the fact that this seems like an immaterial phenomena. And I think it's all tied together. And, you know, there's hard cryptozoology and there's soft cryptozoology, to go off on sort of a little bit of a tangent here. I think cryptozoology as a whole is going to be the last people to acknowledge this sort of loosey-goosey, non-materialist worldview that we're reality that we're living in. But, you know, there's hard cryptozoology that's like, we haven't discovered this or that. And there's this sort of what I would like to call the more soft cryptozoology, which is, you know, the people who brush over reports of Bigfoot disappearing, or the people who you know, want to think the chupacabra is a flesh and blood creature, the Puerto Rican chupacabra, at least, even though it exhibits characteristics that are much more in line with alien phenomenon. You know, I feel like we're moving towards this. The phenomena, whatever it is, as a whole, is pushing us towards two conclusions, one of which is it's all part of the same thing, or it's all using similar methods, A, and B, that it's much more tied in with undermining the materials paradigm that we're in. Sorry, everybody, this is the kick that I've been on. My last blog post was about this, so I've been thinking about it quite a bit.
And that could be found at joshuacutchin.com.
Again, rant over. That's my rant over.
And you know, I mean, people will occasionally say to me, well, how do you know it's not extraterrestrial? And I don't. Even if all this stuff is connected, it could be extraterrestrial in some form. You know, I mean, it's more of just an open question. I don't think it is a matter of flesh and blood, nuts and bolts craft coming here the hard way from another galaxy. Well, I don't think the evidence supports that.
And again, it's this idea that it's this very Western, very sort of English American idea that you're either with us or you're against us. It has to be one thing or the other. And I don't think that really conveys the nuance of the phenomena. I've said this numerous times that if you look at the UFO phenomena, you know, capital letters, quote unquote, it's going to be partially misidentification. It's going to be partially unconventional experimental aircraft, and that might even make up 90%. And it might be that 10% of legitimate nuts and bolts spacecraft. That's fine, but there's a substantial chunk that is something to do with consciousness. And again, the idea that, I mean, I'm also into hybrid theories. The idea that maybe it is extraterrestrials, but they are, you know, maybe the extraterrestrials are the lights in the sky. That's a living thought form, and it projects other experiences of more relatable humanoid beings into our minds. I think that there's some, if we could ever arrive at a point where we know everything about the phenomena, whatever it is, I think that we would find that there's a lot more nuance and a lot more of a mixed solution at play.
Yes.
Then anyone wants to admit, myself included. because I'm big on the anti-materialist bandwagon these days. But but I think that it's a multifaceted answer, and no one really wants to deal with that ambiguity.
That's true. That is very true. And the thing I was just going to say escaped me.
It happens.
Huh. Look at ghost phenomena. You could have ghost phenomena that is the spirit of a dead person. You could have ghost phenomena that is somehow a recording of something that's happened in the past, repeating itself, or that you're tuning into. Or you could have ghost phenomena that is part of a different phenomena masquerading as ghost phenomena. In which case, when you're trying to look at all this as one thing, it doesn't make sense. Because, like, you know, the whole basically the stone tape theory, I think, was the initial version of it, that some of these things record high energy events in the area. So when you see something that keeps repeating, well, that's, you know, that was recorded in the environment somehow, and some people are capable of accessing it, or it becomes more prominent at certain time periods for whatever reason. I would bet my life on the fact that we survived death in some form. for irony there. If we don't, and we won't know, so it's whatever. But I think that the evidence supports some kind of existence past death, whether or not our personalities exist for any length of time, or if we just become part of something else, I don't know. I think it is entirely possible that some people don't leave right away and they stick around for whatever reason, and that this is some of what people are interacting with are the actual spirits of the departed. But then you got, you know, the demonic things and stuff like that, where you're going, what exactly is happening here? You also have ghosts that are seen to be tulpas that we are creating, that people have gone in and intentionally created a ghost, and then people have witnessed it. There was one in, and I'm trying to think if it was David Weatherly that I talked to about it, down south somewhere. They had created this ghost of this woman, and everyone believed this ghost existed, and they kept experiencing her, and they had pictures that seemed to resemble the way this woman supposedly looked, and then they found out this woman never existed.
Yep.
And it was just created by people's belief that this is who was haunting them. So in that case, it can be that our brains are creating a tulpa or something is taking on the form that we believe it's going to take. You know, it could be there's something there, but it doesn't have a solid appearance. And the more we believe, oh, it's this, the more that form solidifies and it becomes that thing.
Right. I totally agree with that. And it's the funny thing where, I mean, you know, as a Christian, I have beliefs about the afterlife, but I have to say, in terms of what is conventionally held belief, that even though I feel like the evidence points towards a survival of consciousness after death, it certainly doesn't point to there being an infinite survival of consciousness after death in any sort of way. So does that mean that, you know, there's a sort of a half-life of the survival of consciousness after death in the form of a haunting, or if there is like sort of a reverse half-life, like the longer someone's been gone, the more likely they are to haunt, which sort of seems like what you see. But you know, it's also interesting to me that ghost/spirit, because I'm more comfortable nowadays saying spirit research as opposed to ghost research, because ghost has so much baggage about the souls of the dead. So spirit research has been very much on the bandwagon for a long time about residual hauntings versus, you know, intelligent hauntings and that sort of thing. And I feel like ufology and cryptozoology, to a certain point, have to adopt a similar model, not saying that everything about the phenomena is this one thing. You know, there are certain, and not saying that it's not all weird, but there, you know, in ghost phenomena, you have hauntings that play out themselves like a tape recording. You have hauntings that that tend to interact with people. You have hauntings that tend to impart knowledge that only the deceased would know. and so they've put these into these sort of discrete categories, and they've noticed these trends, but in the ufology, it's still a free-for-all. It's still lights in the sky. Everybody jump. For the most part, you know, the circles that I like to travel in don't necessarily think that way, but for the most part, it's either aliens or nothing. And that's not the way it should be.
Right.
And similarly, cryptozoology, Bigfoot, or I keep on going back to Bigfoot because he's the crypto darling, but like everybody wants it to be undiscovered animals, which again, I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I'm reading this book right now called A Manifestation of Monsters by Carl Schuchar. It's fantastic.
Yes.
It is great. It is a deep cut crypto fiends book because it gets into the boring parts of cryptozoology. Like, are there unexplained species of frog? Like, and I love it because of that.
And that's out on Anomalous Books, and I'm hoping to have him on sometime soon as well.
It's a great book. It's a great book. But so I'm not saying that that's not part of it, but also like to say that that's everything that's going on with every unexplained strange animal, all the way through Dog Man, you know, these anthropomorphized dog beings, is a bit naive, I think. And if the spirit research community can distinguish between different types of hauntings, then the least we can do in ufology and in cryptozoology is to sort of distinguish between different aspects that might. Different compartments, different segments of the phenomena that sort of lend themselves to discrete categorization.
Okay. All right. One of the things I wanted to address here too, which I just pulled up, someone had put an entry in our forum called "Is Where'd the Road Go Anti-Scientific?" And I'm going to read this because I think it makes some interesting points and we can, you know, discuss. It says, first of all, let me start by saying that I really enjoy the show, and I'm actually a very regular listener, especially when you have Greg Bishop, Nick Redfern, or Micah Hanks on. However, I am also an R&D chemist at a Fortune 500 hygiene company, where there have been times where I've wanted to reach through my digital media device. I refrain from specifying because I currently listen to the show on three different devices, and grab Soraya or his guest by the collar and scream, "That is pure speculation. You're totally ignoring science." I most recently felt this way when Tim Badal was on, and both Tim and Soraya were going off on Neil deGrasse Tyson for simply making a statement that learning science is a good way to learn how to observe the world. I actually don't remember that part that he's referring to, but now I understand how people with a non-science background can take statements like that as being full of arrogance, but at the same time, I feel that the same way when Soraya beats up anyone who might show a preference for the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Listen, I understand that the ETH is probably not the complete answer, but to simply toss it away in favor of psychosocial or simply we'll never know kind of defeats the purpose of even researching the universe. Oh, I'm sorry, researching the subject. Another area of interest to me is full of anti-scientific tendencies is the whole electric universe idea. If you really delve into what they are trying to point out, their views totally ignore proven phenomena like gravitational lensing, which properly be explained by the gravitational effects of dark matter, but falls flat trying to be explained by electromagnetic influences. All in all, I love the show, but I just think that sometimes Soraya and the guests perform an act of mental masturbation whereby the thoughts they throw out feel good in the end, but you are left in the same place where you were when you started. So what does everyone think? Am I a stuck-up scientist who thinks he knows everything? Am I missing something completely obvious? Am I hitting on anything that anyone else has noticed? So I don't actually remember that comment in the Tim Banal interview, and I'm kind of surprised I would say that science is not a good way of observing the universe, because I would say it is.
I think that the common question was a tweet that I brought up, which was deGrasse Tyson saying, when you train your mind how to think, you inoculate yourself against those who desperately want to tell you what to think, which is still to my mind an incredibly ironic tweet from someone who is sort of leading the modern, in a lot of ways, sort of the modern materialist movement. But having said that, it's not science itself that ever bothers me. And I don't think it's science itself that bothers you or Tim. It's the surety with which people are willing to lay claims at the feet of science, if that makes any sort of sense. It's this idea that well, the continued idea that stymies progress, that says that if you are bringing in something that is a completely foreign concept to the scientific paradigm, it cannot exist. Which is something that is rampant in a lot. I mean, you look at the sort of scientific movement of the past several years in terms of even something as simple as nutrition. I mean, everyone is really tending to walk back ideas on the role that fat and cholesterol play in the roles of diets. You look at many understandings that we've had throughout time that tend to walk back similar claims. You look, back at pharmaceutical trials that are replicating only a fifth of the time. All these things tend to add up to the fact that, tend to add up to the conclusion that perhaps we are being a little bit too critical of alternative interpretations of the data.
There's the whole peer review process, which has come under fire over the last few years. There was one group that took peer-reviewed papers that were accepted. They changed the names on them so that they were from less reputable places, put the same paper through the same process, and it got rejected. There were others that they put really prominent names on and basically wrote gobbledygook, and they got accepted. Now, that doesn't mean the peer review process should be thrown out or anything, but it means that there is some bias to accepted ideas and to certain names. If you're publishing from Harvard rather than a community college, you're more likely to get your peer-reviewed paper through because of where you're from or who you are.
Right.
And it's a natural human bias. I definitely do not consider myself anti-scientific. I think science is awesome. I mean, we started this whole conversation out with technology. And, I mean, that's what I do for a living is I fix computers and I design websites and I work with video and photography and audio and all this other stuff. And that's all technology and all science. And from my early days, I loved science. When I was growing up, I wanted to be a scientist. I wanted to initially be an archaeologist because I wanted to look for ancient civilizations until I found out that archaeologists don't really do that. And then I wanted to be an astronomer so I could look for aliens. And then I found out they don't really do that.
Well, science is still literally the best tool that we have to describe existence and reality. And I totally will throw my weight behind that 100%. It's one of the reasons why I share the sentiment that Rupert Sheldrake shared when writing the foreword for Alex Sakaris' book, Why Science is Wrong About Everything. You know, science is great for telling me about what I need, you know, technology or, certain, aspects of physics. Science gave my mom a knee replacement. Thank you, science. You know, that's great. Totally. But I think this is a nuanced thing because number one, I think that perhaps we've been too quick to assume that certain things are laws. They're more like guidelines.
Right.
To paraphrase Pirates of the Caribbean. And I think that there is some validity to Alex's core argument in his collection of interviews in Why Science is Wrong About Everything. Because if you insert the uncertainty that scientifically proven, psi phenomena exert in day-to-day life, then you have to sort of, everything goes out the window. And not everything goes out the window in the fact that I'm going to, I can defy gravity or something, but everything goes out the window in the fact that these are more like guidelines rather than laws. The fact that these things can be influenced by factors that are outside of what we recognize. And more to the point of the original poster at the forums, I definitely understand the sentiment that the supernatural is part of the natural and the paranormal is part of the normal. I just think it's just different ways that we have of describing these things. It's more like we're I think that we live in, for example, we live in a paranormal world that we fit the normal into, as opposed to a normal world that we sort of graft the paranormal onto, if that makes any sort of sense. Not saying that it's any of it's unnatural, you know, or miraculous. I think that a lot of it is quite natural and quite in some ways mundane, more mundane than we realize.
We just don't understand it and how it interacts with us. Yes. I mean, my argument is that we don't really understand reality. We think reality is one thing and it's not that thing.
Right.
And this is why some of this stuff doesn't fit. But as far as determining laws and behaviors of things, science does a fantastic job. The problem is science is so – it gets so ingrained and so dogmatic. When you look at tectonic plate theory, when it was originally proposed, the guy who proposed it was laughed out of academia. You know, I forget the exact details, but you can look it up. He was basically blackballed.
He was.
For coming up with this theory of tectonic plate theory. And, you know, 40 years later, they're like, ooh, look what we discovered. And it's like, no, well, I mean, he was telling you this 40 years ago and you were laughing at
it. We're literally seeing this in action with Graham Hancock. If you've been paying attention over the past, 30, 40 years, this is literally what we're seeing with Graham, because a lot of the modern archaeological evidence is coming out in support of him.
Yes. And when the and Graham had – what book was it? I want to say it's Underworld. He talks about the cities off the coast of India toward what's the small island area southeast of India. There's a little island there. Not a little. It's a big island, and I can't remember what it's called. You know what I'm talking about?
A big island off the – I'm talking about – wait, India or Africa? Madagascar?
India. No, not Madagascar.
Yeah, somebody's. This is the internet, so someone is yelling at us right now, right now. You get the no prize, whoever's yelling at us.
But they were initially connected by a land bridge, and he had said, "Well, you know, the stories say that this land bridge was here, and that these cities were eventually swept up by, you know, rising sea levels." Sri Lanka. So Sri Lanka and India were connected at one point by a land bridge. And this is not argued that they were once connected, but they were supposed to have these big cities on this where this land bridge was, and they eventually got swallowed up. And I don't know, they were like eight cities or something. And then there's a present city there or present temple there or whatever. And they basically told Graham, no, you're wrong. There are no temples under the water there. And then the tsunami hit back in 2001, and it uncovered one of these temples. But nowhere in the article did I see, oh, Graham Hancock said this, you know, in his book or whatever. It just ignores it.
Right, right. It's almost, again, it comes back to it's not science. It's the arrogancy of the people who practice it sometimes. It's this idea that, like, well, that's been out there, of course. Well, some kook said it, but, you know, the idea was floated around, and we sort of talked around it and in the halls of academia, and we decided that perhaps it was a valid point. No, you've got to give credit where credit's due, even if the person at the time seemed like a kook.
All really new revolutionary ideas seem kooky.
They do. And they're met with skepticism and derision. And until finally they're at the very least, they're synthesized, you know, in a Hegelian dialectic sort of way. But this whole argument about being anti-science brings you back to something that the gun control lobby always sort of talks about with gun control. And this isn't intended to be a political statement. It just brought to mind, like, the implementation of this. They often say, if guns kill people, then can I blame my pencil for misspelled words? And I feel like, if we turn this on its head, again, not being political, not validating that statement at all, but if we turn this on its head, you can't blame science for what scientists do. You know, it's the human element of fallibility. And science is great. Science is fine. It's the people who employ it who often – sometimes they're altruistic, but a lot of times they're not. A lot of times it's tied up in ego. It's tied up in career. It's tied up in funding. It's tied up in preserving the status quo.
Money.
Yeah.
Money.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Because no matter how ethical or honest of a scientist you are, you have to be able to present results. You have to be able to back up your research. You have to follow a certain paradigm. You can't just throw something out there because if it flops, you're not going to get funded. You're going to be out of a job.
Right. Right. And, you know, I try to give these people grace. What we really want, what we as the Fringe community really want is just a non-derisive place at the table. We don't want to be made, we don't want to be talked down. I mean, yes, does the burden of proof lie on us to prove some of these things? Well, the burden of proof lies upon us to prove some of our theories, but the burden of proof does not lie upon us to prove that some people are seeing strange things. The burden of proof doesn't rely upon us to say that people are hiking 20 miles into the wilderness and encountering somebody with 18-inch feet running around barefoot, leaving footprints. The burden of proof does not lie upon that. The burden of proof lies upon proving the theories. All we want is a seat at the table, and we've never gotten that really in any sort of substantial way.
And to address the electric universe thing, I do have a soft spot for the electric universe. I will admit that. I really like the idea. I don't know that it's completely right, but I think that there is an electrical aspect that has simply been left out and ignored in this stuff. And you're seeing it more and more come into play in mainstream science, where they're starting to acknowledge this idea that there are electromagnetic things going on. And he talks about, you know, gravitational lensing and dark matter. Dark matter is one of the things that bugs me. Now, if tomorrow they can come up with a scientific report proving the existence of dark matter and dark energy, I will totally accept that. But they have not done that. Dark matter is the theory that needs to be there to make everything else work, and we can't find it. It doesn't seem to be there. And if it was a, if this was a like a pseudo theory off to the side, you know, it would be like, well, why are you even? You can't prove this exists. This is nonsense. But because they need it for the mainstream theory to work, they keep looking. They keep, you know, it has to be there. We know it's there. We just have to figure out how to find it. But until they can actually lay it at our feet and say, okay, here it is, I'm not going to – that's not an acceptable explanation to me.
Well, no, in some ways it's working backwards from solution. And the way that I sort of feel like about the electric universe stuff is so take for – I don't know, a movie with a bunch of twists, so like, or a big twist. Like take, for example, let's say The Sixth Sense. So – this is a 17-year-old movie, spoiler alert, whatever. But you can go through that movie, and that movie could have ended with, guess what? This little kid keeps on seeing dead people. And Bruce Willis is a, you know, is a child psychologist who's alive and is talking to the kid, and that's it. And it would have made sense. It would have made sense. But at the end, there's a reveal that Bruce Willis is one of the dead people that he sees. And it makes a lot more sense. Yeah. And that's sort of the way that I look at the electric universe stuff. Like, does it add up with the current paradigm? Of course it does. And it could be that mundane, but you have to say, hey, look, there's some outliers here that really do fit into this other idea pretty well. And don't discredit the other things that are, you know, commonly held. You have to at least acknowledge that.
Yeah. And I think they explain both Mars and Venus in a very convincing way. Now, when they get into their whole Saturn theory, then I start to have some serious doubts. I'm not going to say, you know, no, that's impossible, because I don't think there's anything that's quite impossible. We may not understand it completely, but I don't think they have enough to really sell me on that one yet. But when you look at the damage on Mars and they can recreate this stuff in a lab, and it's unlike most mainstream science, it's not all mathematics. It's actually physically testable. That interests me. When they landed on the when we landed a probe on the comet a few years back, they had on the Electric Universe page a whole list of predictions of what would happen and what they would find when they landed on the comet. And they were on they didn't get any of them wrong. A few of them were unproven one way or the other, but they were dead on almost every one. And when you looked at the mainstream science's predictions, most of them were wrong.
Well, isn't that one of the things that we laud about the scientific method is predictability? I mean, It's
well, yes, but it also needs it to adapt to change too.
Right. And but I guess what I'm saying is that, like, a lot of the talk that gets perceived of on podcasts such as this one as being anti-science isn't anti-science. In fact, I think it's extremely pro-science in a lot of ways, because it really is holding to the ideals of questioning. It's really trying to be fair and balanced about fair and balanced. It's a loaded phrase. It's trying to be balanced about which viewpoint or where the evidence really takes us, without sort of, you know, having to adhere to something else. And in a lot of ways, in that particular example, you know, the electric universe model was able to be more predictive than current mainstream thought. Not that either one is more scientific than the other. I think that both ideas are scientific. It's just that one was a little bit more predictive, so therefore I think maybe it should be given a little bit more credence.
At least, you know, and I'm not saying we should throw out everything we have on cosmology and all that, but look at the ideas. Look at, maybe we can incorporate one into the other to help explain some things.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, because again, the answer is probably a hybrid answer.
Yes. Yeah. And I also feel like, you know, if we jump 200 years in the future, we're going to look back at this time and be like, look at all this stupid stuff they believe. They called this science.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of the narrative of modern thinking, you know, or of science in general. It's this constant reevaluation of what we've thought is concrete.
And now we have Red Pill joining us.
Hello.
Finally. And you were just before we started recording, you were saying something about Wired magazine.
Yeah, I read a really interesting article about artificial intelligence, about how in the future we won't be coding or making programs to make computers do things. We will teach them the way you teach, I don't know, a dog or even a child, you know, because that is the way that the most powerful artificial intelligence programs operate. You know, one example they give is AlphaGo, this program or networks of computers that managed to beat the human champion of the world. I don't remember the name of the guy. He's Korean and he's something of a national hero. And it was more of a big deal than when Deep Blue beat up Kasparov in the 1990s, you know, the master chess champion. So because Go is infinitely more complex than chess. And what was interesting about it is how the author of the article made a comparison how we've been trying to understand nature and the universe based on of our current technology. So in the age of enlightenment with Isaac Newton, people started to think of the universe as a big clockwork machine. Now, then we moved to the age of digital machines, and now we think of computers as of the universe as a computer. And what was interesting about this article is how the way that we are starting to create artificial intelligence, in that engineers and the programmers don't really know how these their own creations manage to make the decisions they come up with. You know, the people who programmed AlphaGo really don't have a clue of why and how did their creation manage to beat up this human champion. So that is kind of a big deal, how in a way this could be considered the end of the age of enlightenment, the end of the age in which we thought that rationalism alone could explain reality. You know, we thought that maybe if we manage to learn enough about the world, we could, you know, come up with really basic set of principles, logical principles that could explain everything. But now it seems that artificial intelligence will be solved or will be created in a very non-rational way, you know, or ways, or maybe another way of saying it is that these machines will operate in ways that human rationality will not be able to understand it. And if we don't understand our own creations, what does that say about our attempts to try to understand the whole universe?
Huh.
Well, you know what I'm thinking of? I'm thinking of that last night at Paramania, Red.
Mm. Mm.
And what happened?
Oh, what did it happen? Well,
are you two married and you didn't tell anyone?
Well, what stays in Dallas? What happens in Dallas stays in Dallas.
Oh, exactly. Well, the thing is that we managed to meet a guy who was really interesting and kind of intimidating, you know, because he was so smart. And the guy was also heavily involved with artificial intelligence. And he was trying to explain to us in as much of a layman term as he could manage the things that he did with his programs and how he created these artificial intelligence algorithms in order to satisfy the demands of his clients.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's definitely the way that things are going. Like, I think that it's going in this sort of direction, and it's a little bit more than a little bit frightening, because once you start like training code to think, then it seems like a really good recipe for it to get out of your hands.
Well, yeah.
Well, maybe it's inevitable that things get out of their hands of their creators. You know, I mean, there seems to be a property or a propensity of complex systems to
ghost in the machine.
Yeah, I mean, what is called as emergent behavior, you know, something that isn't really right. Coded by the programmers, but kind of like emerges on its own, and it's really freaky and also fascinating at the same time.
The question is, what does that say about consciousness?
Exactly. What does that say about, I don't know, magic?
Yeah.
Well, I think of the anecdote, which isn't entirely accurate after watching all 48 hours of the Lord of the Rings appendices. But I'm reminded of the anecdote that the algorithm that they used to create some of the Lord of the Rings computer generated battle sequences.
Oh yeah.
Actually, in some of the battles, turned around and ran.
Mm-hmm.
Which, because they realized that they were outnumbered. But as I recall in those appendices, those were stories were a little bit outdated. But I mean, like, you don't even have to look to technology for this. I mean, the idea of the created thing taking on a mind of its own and spiraling out of control is even evident in art. I mean, almost every artist has had a moment where something, I don't care what it is, if it's a moment of improv or if it's a novel series where the characters take on a mind of their own, whatever it happens, a lot of times the art will sort of escape from you and do its own thing and sort of channel you through it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, I have the feeling that consciousness in our reality pervades everything. And it's one of the things I do think science is missing, so that I think anytime you get an intelligent system, it can start sort of aggregating consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that might, you know, and I mean, does that consciousness survive? Maybe after it gets to a certain point, it doesn't need the physical system to aggregate anymore.
Mm.
So if we create an intelligence, you know, or a system that can generate its own intelligence and continue to expand, you get that ghost in the machine. And at what point could that consciousness continue on without the machine?
So complexity generates consciousness, and then consciousness trumps or transcends that complexity in a way.
It's an idea anyway.
Interesting.
Because you do have the emergent idea of consciousness that you know, the system gets complex enough, you get the illusion of consciousness. Mm-hmm. However, that does not explain telepathy. It doesn't explain out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences. As much as materialist scientists like to try and pretend they can, the explanations fall flat. Mm-hmm. And there's more than enough evidence that we have scientific evidence that we have precognition, at very least.
It was the Sorry, I was going to say that this was the very topic that you used for your latest blog post, isn't it, Joshua?
Yeah, that's come up like 8 times on this particular episode. But yeah, I know you weren't here. Ah, that was your fault. It's to me, it's an open and shut case. There's enough evidence to support this that psi phenomena does exist beyond statistical thresholds of chance. And once that happens, then you've just got to sort of, you know, throw up your hands, because that takes a lot of stuff off the table, or rather, instead of taking stuff off the table, puts everything on the table in all these sort of phenomena. Not to say that you can't be thorough about it and that you can't be rational about it, but you really have to reevaluate a lot of things that you didn't think that you had to at one point.
Hmm. Okay. I want to see if there was anything else we didn't respond to in that forum post. I think I pretty much covered my thoughts on it. I mean, and I think too, you got to remember that everyone is biased.
Yeah.
So, there's no escaping that. We all see the world a different way. We have different experiences that have led us to this point. We have different stuff around us. Our brains all work a little bit differently. And whether or not consciousness is separate from the brain or not, the brain is the interface with this reality. So, you know, I mean, no one sees the world the same way. So everything's always going to be biased in perspective.
Yeah, we are all products of our circumstances.
Yeah.
Yeah, and returning to this forum post, like, this is, please, send this sort of thing our way, because you're engaging, and that's what we want. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not absolutely. That, you know, I don't want anybody to think that we're sort of, like, writing it off, like, oh, no, well, science is still stupid. We're not saying that at all. Like, you're fighting the good fight by asking questions about that in a forum like this. Like, please. It's the sort of thing that should be encouraged.
And I will call myself a skeptic, and I didn't, you know, I never really thought about it before, but I call myself a skeptic because I doubt everything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it's accepted science or some, you know, crazy, theory somebody has, I'll look at them all pretty equally. And yes, the amount of evidence that can support something comes into that, and you know, that evaluation. So mainstream science gets a little more, you know, has more evidence supporting it, I guess we could say. But I also look at that evidence. For instance, and this goes back to the electric universe. I saw an article that said super, you know, largest black hole ever discovered, found or whatever. And I said, oh, okay. And I clicked on it. And as I read between the lines of this and looked at what they actually found, all they found were a bunch of X-rays and gamma rays that were extremely strong that they couldn't explain. Thus, they assume it's a black hole. Now, it's entirely possible it's a black hole. However, what they really found were X-rays and gamma rays they can't explain. That does not prove it was a black hole.
It's interesting how... when it comes to these scientific theories, you know, the scientific theories that have managed to create our current technological civilization, there comes a moment in which they break down, where when they reach a certain threshold or scale. For example, Newtonian physics, it works, it still works really, really well when you try to calculate the position of celestial bodies like planets or even spaceships, you know. But when it comes to try to explain what happens to gravity at the speed of light or things like that, then it is incomplete, and that's when you need to take out the general theory of relativity. But the general theory of relativity also breaks down when you try to apply it to quantum phenomena. And yes, quantum phenomena breaks down when you're trying to take it to the next level, and that's when they're trying to come up with alternatives like string theory, which is a really elegant theory mathematically, but it hasn't been proven, you know, by observation yet. So
right,
it's interesting, you know. It's like, I don't know, science becomes something of a toolbox, and whenever you're trying to solve a certain problem, oh well, you take out a certain tool from the toolbox and then you solve the problem. But we haven't really managed to come up with the what we will call the Swiss knife of theories, you know, the one size fits all. And I think you're right. You know, you guys are right. I also consider that the missing piece in order to create the Swiss knife is consciousness. You know, and I think that only a handful of scientists are brave enough, or at least curious enough, in order to try to reach this side of the argument that used to be only the provenance of mystics, you know, gurus and Buddhist monks.
We also have to acknowledge, though, too, that there is a difference between media science and actual science.
Yeah,
you know, the media will take a scientific discovery and break it down into a simplest form and present it as if it's fact, when the scientists behind it are sitting there going, we never said that was a fact.
Exactly.
But they have to make it black and white for the people they're reporting it to.
And the meme gets perpetuated.
Right, exactly.
Sure, and maybe some scientists won't mind the hyperbole that is brought up by mainstream media and popular science magazines, if that gets him to, you know, if that gets more funding for their research.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say that we're not actually anti-scientific at all. I know I don't feel that I'm anti-scientific. Of course, most people don't feel they're anti-scientific unless they outwardly hate science for some reason. I want to look at all sides of it, and I completely appreciate everything science has given us and all the technology has given us and the amazing things we can do with what we do understand about the universe. I just don't think it's I think we're limiting ourselves.
But at the same time, call us out. Like, call everybody out.
Absolutely.
Call everyone out for everything. Keep it up, because
That, and if anyone wants to respond, they can go to the forum.
Yeah.
You know, because at the end of the day, there really is no quote-unquote science as independent, you know, self-sufficient entity, right?
Right.
There is no science. There are scientists. There's people who try to apply something called the scientific method. And like you said, you know, those people are also not without their certain bias, you know, their certain way to look at things, their certain way to try to look at the world. So that's the problem, you know. We are always trying to reach this perfect or unreachable state of pure objectivity. And I think that that is something of a mirage, you know. I mean, even quantum theory has demonstrated that, there cannot be perfect objectivity. The moment that you look into a problem, or even if you look into a certain experiment, the very act of observing it is already changing it. You know, yeah. So you cannot be a completely independent observer that is, you know, completely outside of what you are observing. You know, there is this dynamic and really, really complex involvement between observation and experimentation. And that again also hints at the fact that the basic principles in which the age of enlightenment and our modern industrial society are not as perfect as we thought they were. You know, once again, it's a matter of we have reached a certain threshold in which our tool no longer serves the purpose that was intended to.
That's a great way to put it. And
yes,
I'm sort of at a loss to follow that up, but but to me, in a little bit more metaphorical terms, science is a box of. It's a tool. It's as you said, it's a toolbox. Mm-hmm. But science right now is in the hands of auto mechanics. And it's like they're ignoring that avionics exists at all.
Nice.
And it's the same thing. But they're just the same thing, same box of tools, but it's a different philosophy. It's a different it's using the same means to a different end that they're just not acknowledging. And I would like to see some acknowledgement of that.
Okay. All right. And like I said, people can post whatever they want in our forum, start up a conversation, whatever. It's right on wheredidtheroadgo.com. And I'm always interested to know what people think, the experiences people have had. And yes, if you want to call us out on something, please do. If we feel it's fair, we'll address it. That's not an encouragement just to go on there and be a jerk either.
The sure, word, sure. Hate forums are hate forums. Jump on the hate forums.